Hello, my name is Dr. Marty Martin, and it's my distinct pleasure to talk with you for a little bit of time about a topic that some of you may find quite important, but yet others may find slightly boring at times, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. What's the topic? It's the psychology of money for psychologists as well as other mental health professionals. So take a look at this image, if you will, and as you look at this particular image, what's striking about it is it's kind of the aspirations and dreams that we have when we're thinking about retirement or we're thinking about relaxing. But one of the things that you have to think about is most people don't plan to fail, they simply fail to plan. So one point I really want to emphasize as we go through this particular presentation is planning is essential. Now, I'm not going to set aside luck, because luck does have its benefits, if you will, but I really want to equip you with focusing on developing a plan that works well for you, given your own life nuances and circumstances. So there are a number of learning objectives that I hope to accomplish by the end of this presentation. So I'd like for you to kind of read them at your leisure and then kind of hold me accountable at the end to make sure that those learning objectives were met. And if you notice, it's a range of objectives. So let's begin with three questions and four jobs of money. So regardless of your position, you may be in private practice, you might be in a group practice, you might be employed. Everyone, and I mean everyone, is dealing with these three questions. And let me begin with the first question. Do I have enough? So do I have enough now? And the other larger question is, will I have enough later? And that's an important question. And we'll address that when we talk about cash flow. The other one is how long will my money last? You know that life expectancy is increasing. So if people still retire, let's say between 55 and 65, but yet they live to 80 to 85, that's a lot, that's several decades they need to be able to live. It used to be the case that people would retire at 55 and they'd drop dead at 56, so you only had to fund about a year, but that's no longer the case. The next question is this the right choice for me? What do I mean by that? When you decide to get a credit card, there's an array of options that you have to look at. Interest rates, are they fixed? Are they variable? What's the credit limit? And if you think about retirement plans, do I do an ETF? Do I do a mutual fund? Do I do a bond? Do I do a stock? So you have all these choices before you. So it's extremely important that you develop a financial plan in advance so that way you can make informed decisions and not emotional decisions. Because when the market is going up, people get happy, they get excited if they're in the market, and what they tend to do is buy in a very casual way. And if the market is going down, people get appropriately nervous, a little bit upset, and they may hold back. But if you have a financial plan, it provides some guidelines for decision making and also enables you to address these three questions. So now let's look at the four jobs of money. Money has a purpose. It does have some symbolic value, but it does things. The first thing that money does, it's a medium of exchange. So we tend to use currency. Some of you may be familiar with Bitcoin. So Bitcoin was kind of this digital currency. People were excited about it. People were exchanging it, and then all of a sudden it kind of fizzled away, but it hasn't completely disappeared. I think in our lifetimes, we're going to be looking at digital currencies, not necessarily paper and coins. So medium of exchange. The other is it's a standard of value. So if someone pays for your clinical services, let's say $150 an hour, that's a value to that $150 an hour. If they write a check, it's still $150. If they pay cash, $150. And let's say that you charge $150 and you collect $150 from reimbursement, it's still $150. So that's a constant value. And typically within the United States, that value is backed by what they call the full credit of the United States. So a standard of value. Then you also have a store of value. So let's imagine that you have $200,000 in your bank account. So you're not going to have $200,000 actually in paper dollars and in coins. So you're going to have them in terms of basically electronic transactions. So money also stores value. So it has a medium of exchange, a standard of value, and a store of value. And the last job of money, it's a standard for deferred payment. So think about an IOU. Or if you're dealing with insurance companies, you have deferred payments. If you're practicing in certain states where there's Medicaid, and the state is really suffering it from a budgetary perspective, they may owe you a lot of money for services that were rendered. So we've just talked about the three questions of money and the four jobs of money. And the reason why I want to begin with that is just to get people comfortable with the notion about what is this thing that we call money. So it does have some emotional pieces, but it also does certain jobs. Now let's pause and think for a moment about money. As you know, the American Psychological Association has done a number of surveys, and they call these surveys Stress in America. And the amazing thing is that money and financial stress has basically stayed in the top three for the least 5 or 6 years. And that's really not too surprising, because many of us, regardless of our income, regardless of our educational level, money is a stressor. So money might be a stressor because you don't have enough. In some cases, you may have too much. And I'm not Freudian in terms of my perspective, but Sigmund Freud said that really the two drivers of life are love and work. Now, he didn't mention money directly, but work involves money, and unfortunately for a lot of people, love may involve money as well. So I think Freud was onto something. So what my hope is by the end of this presentation is that you experience a little bit less stress in your own life and in the lives of your patients with regard to money. If you notice, I said less stress, not no stress. So now let's look at a relationship that you may have with money. And this could be upsetting to some people, because you can say, hey, Marty, I don't have a relationship with money because money's not another person. Money is an object. Money is a thing. Well, be patient for a moment, and then you be the judge after I introduce a couple concepts about relationships and money. So fundamentally, I'm going to look at there's a biological response that we have to money. There's a belief system that we have developed about money. And we have characteristic behaviors or habits about money. Krueger said, he wrote about the psychoanalysis of money, central motivation for many in our society. Money is the central motivation. Not for all, but for many. And I think that's something that you at least need to acknowledge, even if you disagree with it. So let's look at the biology of money as the first B. This came from a survey that looked at neuroscience and money. And I'd like to read it, and read along it with me as well. Our results show that earnings beat the consensus analyst forecast are associated with increased striatal bold activity, while earnings missing the consensus forecast lead to decreased activity. So let me unpack what that means. So a corporation, they release earnings typically on a quarterly basis. So say, for example, you have Apple. So Apple, if they beat their earnings estimate, then their stock is going to go up. But if they don't beat their earnings estimate for the quarter, their stock will go down. So in this neuroscientific study, what they found is that they're actually triggers in our brain. So we are reacting not just cognitively, we're reacting not just behaviorally, we're reacting neuropsychologically and from a neuroscientific point of view. And that shouldn't be too surprising. Because imagine this, I hope it never happens, but say you work for a group practice. So you come to work on Monday, life is good, you've got a house, you can pay for certain things, you have a car, and then all of a sudden your boss tells you is, I'd like to see you at 10 o'clock in the conference room. So you're thinking, wow, I've never met with the boss at 10 o'clock in the conference room, maybe this is good news. So you're a little bit apprehensive. So you go to the conference room at 10 o'clock. And when you arrive in the conference room at 10 o'clock, you notice your boss is there and this person that you've never met in a suit. And they're saying, oh, this is getting kind of weird. So after a couple pleasantries, your boss says, you have been fired, effective today. You will have a biological reaction. And it's going to relate to not just self-esteem, not just occupational self-esteem, but you're going to be worried about survival. So when you really think about money, there's some biological triggers, So let's continue with looking at the biology of money. The mere thought of receiving a financial reward activates the pleasure centers in your brain. So if you like to go to Las Vegas, or if you like to go to Macau, or if you like to do a little bit of gambling, that's no surprise to you. Because think about it. Most people don't win more than they lose. So what they're really finding enjoyable is the possibility that they may actually win. So that's what's stimulating. So the expectation of a financial reward can be stimulating. That's another reason why companies use incentives. Because a financial incentive, yep, if it's tied to, you know, high quality performance or productivity, can trigger the pleasure centers of the brain. The other piece too is that we learn about money from reward mechanisms. So it goes back to maybe when you were a little child. So I don't believe parents should do this, but they do, and if you do it, that's okay. They may say to their kids, if you get a B, I'll give you $50. If you get an A, I'll give you $70. So what's the child learning? The child is learning how to respond on an incentive structure. So money can also operate on a learning basis as well. So that was the biology of money. So what's the take-home point there? The take-home point is that money can trigger emotions, cognitions, feelings, and physiological symptoms, including fight or flight. Now let's look at beliefs. So for beliefs are those kind of scripts in your head or schemas, and use the language that's appropriate for yourself. There is a quote-unquote financial psychologist by the name of Klontz. So both his father and he really kind of developed this whole arena of financial psychology. And that term may be controversial for some, but they regard themselves as financial psychologists. And he developed a tool, it's a diagnostic tool that has good reliability and validity, and it's called the Klontz Money Script. And then there's categories. So he describes certain beliefs as money avoidance. So for those people that kind of hold that belief, money is something that is a little bit distasteful. It's something that you kind of push away from. Others are money worshipers, if you will. So for the money worshipers, is they're definitely not pushing away. It's kind of like they're seeking it. They're attracted to it. It's something that goes beyond economic value. It may have symbolic value. Then you have the money status. So the money status is a particular salary or particular balance in the account equals self-worth or as well as self-esteem. A good friend of mine, I'm not going to mention his name because you might know him, that probably 15, 20 years ago, he said, Marty, he said, when I make $150,000, I know then that I would have arrived. I just spoke with them a couple days ago. So now that figure is up to $500,000. He's a dear friend, but in his life, his own self-esteem, his own self-worth is tied to his W-2 income. So I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it's his reality. Then you have the money vigilance. So the money vigilance is you're kind of on alert. Is it going to go away? Am I going to have enough? So there's a little dangers that are looming with regard to money vigilance. So I want to pause for a moment and kind of ask you, as you look at money avoidance, money worship, money status, and money vigilance, to be honest now, which one of those, or you could pick two, would you say pretty well describe you? So what would you say? And what I'd like you to do is maybe ask somebody else, but don't stack the deck. So ask somebody else who can give you kind of an honest response, and what might they say? And do you say the same thing or not? Let's say, for example, you happen to fall more along the line of money worship. That's neither good nor bad, but you have to recognize that. And is it working for you? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. The other thing you have to think about, if you're a committed lifelong relationship, and if you're about money worship and your life partner is about money avoidance, that could cause some challenges. So you can look at this from an individual perspective as well as from a couple perspective. And another way of looking at this is what messages are you giving your children or your grandchildren about money? Because remember, these belief systems, at least not now, not genetically acquired, they come from learned behavior. So modeling and other messages. So society is certainly giving some messages, but what are the messages that you're giving to your loved ones at home? So let's do a quick audit for the money behavior. So I track my spending on a weekly basis. Yes or no? And I'll debrief each one of these. I do not live paycheck to paycheck. Yes or no? I do not engage in compulsive spending. I do not engage in impulsive buying. I do not engage in money infidelity. People say, well, what's money infidelity? It's lying to significant others about what you spend, or it's hiding purchases in the house, that kind of stuff. I pay myself first, savings and retirement. I routinely check my balances, bank balances, retirement balances. And finally, I know my approximate net worth. So those are all your assets. So your assets may be your house, it may be jewelry, it may be some furniture, it may be art, maybe cars, whatever it is, minus your liabilities. So your liabilities are your car note, your mortgage, student debt. So you want to have a positive net worth. Anytime you've applied for a mortgage, then you have to show your net worth in some of the forms. So as you take a look at these quick audit, you definitely want to have some sense of how you're spending money on a weekly basis. So I'm not suggesting that you have to account for every cent, but some general idea. Because those people that may be a little bit impulsive, they'll find that money's kind of slipping away. And then you ask them at the end of the week is, hey, where'd that $400 go? And they'll say, that's a good question. I don't know where it went, because they're really not tracking it. With regard to the compulsive buying, this is when you get in certain conditioned behaviors. You also get in certain habits. And you feel the need that I've got to spend something, or I've got to buy something. Now, the media doesn't help us, because the media is really working against us, because the media wants all of us, including myself, to be impulsive buyers and to be compulsive buyers. And they're kind of in cahoots with the credit card industry, because if we actually don't have the cash, then we get the credit card, and then we get the 10%, 20%, 40% interest. So everybody's winning except for who? Joe and Jane, the consumer. That's the only person that's really not winning, but everybody else is winning from a financial point of view. Occasionally, I'll do a little social commentary. If it's something that you disagree with, then just ignore that part and kind of go on. And the money infidelity. So I think you really have to take a look at that and maybe share with your life partner is, how did you learn about money growing up? What were some of the lessons? Because when you share that backstory, you might be able to get on a similar page with regard to not only money beliefs, but also money behaviors as well. And the one about pay yourself first, you've probably heard it, but I really, really want to emphasize that. Particularly for those of you that may be watching this and you're under the age of 35, listen, please, extremely carefully. You might say, you know, Marty, I don't have an extra dime for retirement. But if I were to say, you know what, did you go to Starbucks? Did you maybe go out with some friends? Did you buy anything like digitally online? You're probably going to say yes. you probably are spending anywhere between $50 to $60 a week for some of you, and at least a month for others, where that money could be allocated in some type of retirement vehicle. Now, I know what you're thinking. Okay, yeah, right. So I'm going to put in $50, $60 a week or a month. What good is that going to do me? Okay, that in and of itself will not do you that good in the future. But there's something that's called the time value of money. And the time value of money is money grows over time because of interest. Yep, so say you have an interest of 2%, because banks aren't paying much, which is why people are going into other vehicles. But you have 2%. So that 2% year over year over year, it can add up. So what was $100 can generate into tens of thousands. So you really want to think about the time value of money. Now, for those of you that are over 50, yep, the IRS has kind of recognized that maybe you didn't save as much as you should have for whatever reasons. So they have these catch-up provisions. So the IRS will say, you know what, if you're over 50, you can set aside, tax-exempt, more money. Why? Because you have less years until you retire. So two lessons there is please make sure that you set aside some savings. And if you're employed and your employer has a match, then definitely take the match, because the match is compensation. If you don't take the match, you're actually leaving money on the table. So try not to do that. And then for your net worth, I think it's a good habit. It's almost like your financial vital statistics, if you will, or your vital signs, rather, is just get a sense of where are you kind of year to year. And you want to be in a positive financial position from a net worth point of view. So we've talked about biology, we've talked about beliefs, and now we're going to switch and talk about behavior a bit. But some might say, well, what about cognition? Where do thoughts come in? Thoughts really come in with regard to the beliefs. So I'm not underestimating that, but that's not the focal point here. But let me talk about one cognition. It's really a heuristic or a cognitive bias that we have. It's called loss aversion. So let me give you an example. Let's say, for example, that I deposit $10,000 in your bank account. So you check it and you say, wow, I've got $10,000 in my bank account. It's cleared, it's legal, it's yours, no strings attached. How are you going to feel? Most people are going to feel great because it's like $10,000 windfall, legal and clear, feeling good. But imagine this. You have $20,000 in the bank and I withdraw $10,000. There's nothing you can do about it. Can't go to law enforcement, FBI, nobody. So I withdraw $10,000 from your bank account. Now how are you going to feel? Bad. Is the upside when I put in the $10,000 equivalent emotionally to the downside when I withdrew it? For most people, not. Because we have something that's called loss aversion. So when we lose something, we have more heightened emotions than when we gain something. So what does that have to do with financial management? When the stock market is going down, people experience loss, they may pull out their money. And if loss aversion is very high, if the market gets ready to go back up, they're gun-shy in terms of getting back in that market. So you really want to think about these losses that we have. Because in general, when you're investing in the stock market, you want to buy low and sell high, or you want to make sure that you, in a disciplined way, contribute to your particular retirement portfolio, you know, every month or every quarter or, you know, every week. So that way you get something that's called dollar cost averaging. So dollar cost averaging is you're buying when it's high, you're buying when it's low. So mathematically, it averages out. But what happens is this. When the stock market is increasing and the media is talking about the rising stock market, you know, your great aunt's talking about the stock market, everybody's talking about the stock market, it keeps going up, going up, going up. Human tendency is to buy. So what we tend to do as humans, we buy when it's high, but we fail to sell. Yep, when it's low. So you really want to think about loss aversion. So I'm not suggesting that you get involved in trading. Trading is a whole different concept, and so I'm not recommending that. But I am recommending is be very attuned as to when you enter and when you exit the market. And you are in the market, because if you have a 401k, if you have a 403b, you're in the market. So don't fool yourself by saying, I'm not an investor. Well, you may not be doing the investing, but you made selections, and based upon that, whoever is holding and managing that account, they are investing. So now let's talk a little bit about interior and exterior finance. And what I mean by interior? So interior, we've alluded to biology, beliefs, and behavior. Exterior, we've alluded to. So we've talked a little bit about markets. So there's two sides to this coin. You can't solve interior issues with exterior solutions. So let me go back to that friend I was telling you about. That initially he said, if I have $150,000, then I'll feel good about myself. Time passed, now that dollar amount has gone up to $500,000. So from your clinical perspective, what is he trying to do? It sounds to me as if he's trying to solve an interior problem with an exterior solution, in his case, money. So I work with a number of wealth management firms. So as a tip, quote unquote, financial psychologist, and one of the things that has really struck me is this, is people with net worth of $10, $20, $30, $40 million, a lot of net worth, but yet deep down inside, there's little self-concept and there's also little self-esteem. And for those that have inherited wealth, they received a lot of messages as they were growing up is, well, you really don't have to worry about school so much. You really don't have to worry about work so much because you're taken care of. And this one particular client, she's about 52 right now. So she finished college. She's done very well in college. But what happened is at the age of 52, she really has no work record. And now she's looking back on her life and saying, what have I done? How have I contributed? And what she's recognizing is she really hasn't contributed to anything or anybody other than herself. So this is kind of a sad story, but the lesson is, perhaps for yourselves, but for your clients, is money will not solve self-concept and self-esteem issues. So we just finished talking about the three B's. So that was biology, that was beliefs and behavior. Now I want to focus on the interior and the exterior parts of finance. So let's go into a bit more detail about that. But let me tell you a quick story that really illustrates this particular slide. So if you remember, I told you about the friend of mine that kind of earlier on a number of years ago, he said that if he were to make $150,000, he'd have a better sense of himself, feel better about himself. And recently I chatted with him, and now that figure's gone up to $500,000. So I think it's very important for ourselves, but probably more importantly for our clients or patients, is that we kind of listen as to whether they're trying to solve self-esteem, relationship, and self-concept challenges with money. And it shouldn't be too surprising because we get a lot of societal messages about doing that. But that's something that you want to be attentive to. And let's go into some more detail about that. So when you think about interior finance, again, it's our beliefs, it's our scripts, it's our behavior. And if you think about exterior finance, now, I know there's some accounting terms here, so I'm going to go into each one in detail, but not too much detail because I don't want to put you to sleep. So we have the balance statement, net worth. We have the income statement, so think about profit and loss. And we have the cash flow statement, can I pay my bills? So those are the three basic accounting statements. There's a book that I'd like to recommend, and you can see it there, called Conscious Finance. And in this book is, they do a fantastic job of integrating that which is interior and that which is exterior. I think the beautiful thing about psychologists and other mental health professionals is we're equipped to really deal with both of these worlds and integrate both of these worlds. So let's take a little look at an excerpt from this book. The evidence suggests that emotions play a crucial supporting role in the mathematical computations needed for reasoned choice. Rather than interfering with it, if emotions and their mathematical counterparts may not always be balanced appropriately. So what does that mean? So how many of you have looked at a retirement statement or you looked at an investment statement? And then while you're looking at it, you experience an emotional shift. Many of you have. That emotional shift may be from neutral to positive. That emotional shift might be from neutral to negative. So when you're thinking about making financial decisions, it's not all based on math. It's not all based on logic. There is the emotion, and there also is the biology part that we talked about as well. So let's go into a little bit of a deeper details into exterior finance. So remember, the balance statement is your net worth. If you apply for a mortgage, they're going to want a statement of your net worth. And your net worth is do you own more than you owe? So do you own more than you owe? And the income statement is your profit and loss. So say you have a practice. So hopefully your practice has greater profits than it does costs. And your cash flow statement is, if you're employing people, can you meet payroll? So those are some kind of simple ways to take a look at it. So if you note on this particular slide, I have assets and I have liabilities. So the assets are valued at $700,000 and the liabilities are valued at $220,000. So this is not high-level math. So based upon this, is it a positive or a negative net worth? And hopefully you said positive, because that $700,000 is greater than $220,000. So if you have a positive net worth, then creditors, it could be bankers, it could be venture capitalists, it could be mortgage companies, then you are worth the risk. But if you have a negative net worth, then you are a financial risk. So related to this, I think it's important for you to take a look at your FICO score. So that way you can really see what your credit rating is. And that's something you want to monitor on an annual basis. Now let's take a look at the green here. So let's say your monthly bills are $4,000 a month, but your monthly income is $3,500. So your bills are more than your income. You have negative cash flow. So then you have to ask yourself the question is, what do people do when they have negative cash flow? And there are a number of options that people can take. So they can try to increase their income. They can try to decrease their expenses. Or, and I wouldn't suggest this strategy, they may take out a home equity loan. I wouldn't do it. They may try to meet that shortfall through credit card debt. Wouldn't do that either, because using that type of financing comes with high interest rates. So let's see about what you would do. So how do I make up for this negative cash flow? So would you cut back on your monthly bills? Would you try to increase your monthly income? Would you use credit cards to make up the difference? Would you take out a bank loan? Or would you take out a home equity loan? So what would you do? And if you have certain clients and patients that are distressed about money, then in a lot of cases, the distressing part of money is negative cash flow. And in fact, they may stop coming to see you, because after all, if you think about psychological treatment and mental health treatment, is that's an expense. So I think you need to monitor what's going on with your clients and your patients' cash flow. Not that you're being intrusive, but if they stop showing up or they want to come every other week or once a quarter, it could be that there's a cash flow problem. So you want to make sure that that surfaces. So now let's look at collections and charges more from a business point of view. So the income statement is profit and loss. So if you happen to be in a group practice or a private practice, you have certain fixed costs. So you have your rent. You may have a 0.5 secretary. You have to pay for utilities, for telephone, maybe for janitorial services. Those are all your fixed costs. You may also have some variable costs as well. So as you provide more services, say you're doing psychological testing, so certain instruments that are required for that, that increases. So you really want to make sure that your cash flow is positive, because your cash flow is going to lead into what? Your income statement. So all these two are very much related. So you really want to make sure that you have profit from your practice. Now, some of you that may be watching, you're just starting up your practice, so you're ramping it up. So I wouldn't expect for you to have a profit if you're just ramping it up. So it's going to be negative for a little while, and that's okay, but you want to make sure it's not perpetually negative. That's problematic. So let's do an example. So we have revenue, let's say at $100. So let's say the cost of goods sold is $50. So then you have a gross profit of 50. So profit is the money that you take in. Now let's say you have operating expenses at $30. So now your operating profit is 20. So you can see from this illustration is a lot of us get very excited about the check that comes in or the electronic transmission. We take a look at it, we say, wow, you know, that was $2,000. That's gross revenue. Once you start deducting all the costs associated to get that and all the operational costs, you can quickly go from 2,000 to maybe 500. So it's important to look at that gross number, but you also want to take out all expenses. Because when you take out all the expenses, then you have what's called your net. And the net is really what you use from a discretionary point of view. Gross is fine, but I really want you to focus on the net more so than the gross. And then let's say you have interest because you took out a loan, and then you have to pay taxes. So now all of a sudden your net profit is $12. So you had 100, but you're only profiting 12. So most of that money went away. So you also want to track what your profit margin is. So in this simple example, your profit, your net profit margin is 12%. But what does that mean? So over time, you want your net profit margin to increase. It's not going to increase to 100%, but you want it to increase. You also want to look at benchmarks. So how are other practitioners? What's their net profit? So how is yours compared to theirs? So that way you can get a sense of how well you're doing. So let's still stay on the interior and the exterior of finance, but ask this question. Does money buy happiness? So you see that smiling couple there that they want a lot of money. I think I'd be smiling too if I won. You could take off a couple of zeros, I'd still be smiling. But that's a lot of money. And yet you see this other woman, yep, so she's in a wheelchair. So who's happier? I mean, who knows? Yep, that's almost kind of an odd question. But if you look at lottery winners, not the day that they get the check, but 1 year after, are they happier before they got the lottery? So what would you say? Are they happier before they won the lottery? If you look a year later, most of them are not. So money does not buy happiness, but we have to have a certain amount of money so that way we're not distressed and we're not on a survival mode. So some economists have looked at within the U.S. at this current point in time, really how much money do people need to have baseline happiness? So this is for an individual. And they're saying for an individual needs between $60,000 to $70,000 to have a baseline of happiness. And it's measured by what they call subjective well-being. And there's a psychologist in downstate University of Illinois by the name of Diener that's done a lot of this work. And the instrument is subjective well-being. And I'll talk a little bit more about it in a minute. So think about it. $60,000 to $70,000 is enough for happiness. So if you get an additional $10,000, are you 10% happier? Research says no. If you get $400,000, are you happier? Research says no. Now, can you do more things with that $400,000? Definitely. You can buy stuff, you can have great experiences, but you may not necessarily be happier. And I think that's an important notion to explore yourself and an important notion to explore with your clients and your patients, because I think the media within the United States gives us the opposite message. If you really want to be happy, then you need more and more and more and more, and what's the limit? And for most people, that's not the case. For some people it is, but for most people it's not the case. So this actually came from a study that was done in the Journal of Personality and Social Psych. So they looked at lottery winners and accident victims. Then they also had control. So you got lottery winners and accident victims. And this is an amazing finding. As predicted, lottery winners were not happier than controls and took significantly less pleasure from a series of mundane events. And what they found that was striking for the accident victims is that their happiness was the same or a bit higher after the accident, but not for the lottery winners. So I'm not saying don't play the lottery, but I'm saying if you do play the lottery and you win, that's a great thing, but don't put a lot of burdens on yourself thinking you're going to be happier, because if you're like the average person, you're going to set yourself up for some disappointment. So now let's continue with the economics of happiness. So some of you may have heard of a country called Bhutan, and it's Bhutan. So Bhutan. And they have the gross domestic product, the GDP, but they also have the GHP. And what do you think the GHP stands for? It's gross happiness product. So there's some economists, behavioral economists, and traditional economists think they're too far out there, that are really looking at a society not only has to have a good GDP, but a good GHP. Because if you look at all goods and services produced by a society, that's an important metric. But all goods and services produced by a society is not reflective of where people are from a happiness or subjective well-being point of view. So let's look at from another study. It appears that a higher income might help if we're not just poor, but very poor. So if you're dirt poor, I mean, money's going to make you a little bit happier because you're suffering. The next finding they found was, on the other hand, strongly desiring large amount of money appears likely to hinder our chances for high subjective well-being. And that's the instrument that you use for happiness. Gaining more income, if we are middle class or upper class and are living in a wealthy nation, is unlikely to substantially bolster subjective well-being on a long-term basis. That's why they do these studies on these lottery winners 1 year afterwards, and there is an initial peak, but then what happens is it kind of fizzles out. The same is true for you. Let's say, for example, you're an employed psychologist or mental health professional, and you get a bonus. And that bonus represents 10% of your base salary. You're going to be happy. Your subjective well-being will increase. But will your subjective well-being stay increased for the next 5 years? Probably not. If you're like most people, it's working for 3 to 6 months, and then it's gradually going to taper off. So you really want to think about that. And I'm going to add a twist to this discussion. I'd imagine some of you work very hard, as well that you should, but what are you working towards? So is it to deliver more services and care for a greater number of individuals, given access issues? Or is it to get this financial target or bogey, thinking that once you hit that financial target or bogey, then all of a sudden you're going to experience happiness? So if it's the former, kind of makes sense. If it's the latter, I would stop and just reflect for a moment about what the behavioral economists, as well as the financial psychologists, have found empirically based upon the economics of happiness. So just think about that and ask yourself why am I putting in 60, 70 hours? What am I actually striving for? Let me tell you another story. Good colleague of mine, he's a fellow psychologist, practices in Philadelphia. So he has about a two-day practice by design because he likes to do a number of other things that are quite leisurely. So that was going well until he got married. And then when he got married, his wife had a different expectation. Her expectation was, well, why don't you work 5 days like everybody else and let's maximize the income? And for him, that would throw his life out of balance because he had enough money for him to meet his needs and beyond, but he valued time and experiences more than money. So they had to negotiate that as a couple. So he's like 3.5 days. So I think that's something you really want to think about for yourselves and think about for your patients and clients as well. So now let's go from a little bit from theory to reflection. So imagine this, that you have all the money you need now and in the future. What will you do with it? But more importantly, how will you live your life? And even more importantly, what will you change? You have all the money that you need now and in perpetuity. How would you live your life? And that's something that you may want to actually write down and reflect upon, or maybe you record it. And after you've done that, then ask yourself this question. Do I need to have all the money now and later to do that? Can I begin to do that perhaps now, even without all the money? Because in a lot of cases, I think we put our life on a deferred payment plan. When I get this, then that's when I can enjoy this. And that may be okay to some degree, but really think about living in the moment. And let me tell you a couple of stories from some of the clients in the wealth management firms that I work with. Is, again, many of these people are ultra high net worth. So $5, $10, $15, $20 million net worth. And then what we really strike upon them is, for many of them, is why aren't you vacationing? Why aren't you enjoying life? Why aren't you spending time with your loved ones? Because you're financially secure. I mean, there's no 100% guarantee. And for many of them is they haven't hit that amount. So they've basically put their life on hold. So I think that's something that you want to think about yourself as well. Think about it for your patients and your clients. Is enjoy life now. And there are many things that you can enjoy in life that you don't necessarily have to incur an expense. So try to enjoy little moments, if you will, little moments. So we just finished looking at the big exercise as it relates to if you had all the money now and in the future, how would you live your life? How would it bring meaning? Now I'd like to introduce another exercise, and this is called the Wheel of Life exercise. And in this exercise, if you'll note, there are a number of different categories by color. And this is how you take a look at this particular exercise. In life, we make different investments in those things that are important to us. So we make investments in our career. When I mean investments, I don't mean money per se, but time, energy, prioritizing. So we make investments in finance, in our relationships, with our friends and family, in our own health, in our personal growth, in hobbies and interests that we hold, as well as the environment. So what I'd like for you to do is maybe sit back and actually using a scale of 100, write in to what degree are you making investments in each one of these categories. And it can be pretty revealing to you. And what you'll find is developmentally, you'll make different investments depending upon where you are. So if you're at the peak of your career, then the career investments could be 40 or 50. If you're retired, the career could be zero. Unless you're doing part-time work, that could be 5. If you're 85 plus, and if you're like most Americans, you have one or two chronic diseases, then health is going to be a little bit bigger. So some of this is developmental, but also it's personal as it relates to what you value. So go back to those beliefs again. And if you're engaged in a kind of a life committed relationship, then have your partner do it as well. So if you do it with someone else, they have theirs, you have yours, and then take a look at it and see whether there's some alignment there. There may not be perfect alignment, but you do want a relatively high degree of alignment. So this is a tool that I would suggest for yourself, and you might even also suggest this for your clients or patients as well. So let's go into a bit more detail about money beliefs and this strange word here called heuristics. So really, heuristics are mental shortcuts that we make when we're making decisions. So one of the points I really want to emphasize is when you are managing your money and managing your finances, you're making a lot of decisions. And there are a lot of decision-making traps or heuristics that we can fall into. So I want to describe these heuristics or these traps so that way you're educated about them and you're less likely to fall into the trap. Or if you do fall into the trap, you can somehow get yourself out of the trap. So these are called cognitive biases. So in fact, this is a topic that's very interesting to me, and it caused me to actually write a book called The Inner World of Money about this subject. So I reviewed the literature in behavioral finance and behavioral economics, and it's pretty pedantic. It's also a little bit boring as well. So I said there's got to be a way that this information can be translated in a way that's palpable, that's a little bit more interesting than the journals, and that people can use. So I'm not pushing the book, but just telling that story. So let's look at cognitive biases. They're mental mechanisms that systematically influence our judgment and our decision making. And for most of us, they're beyond our conscious awareness. So again, my point here is to tell you what they are, in the hopes that you become more conscious of them and not to engage in them on a routine basis. So let's look at the first one. It's called availability bias. So we make decisions based upon the information that's available. That's almost self-evident. Let me tell you about a case in point for a financial decision. So let's say that you know about mutual funds, you know about stocks, you know about bonds, but you've never heard of an ETF. And some of you might be saying, I've never heard of an ETF. What is an ETF? It's an exchange-traded fund. So it's very difficult to make a decision about that you know nothing about. They've also done some fascinating studies looking at investors. So let's say you live in Seattle. And what they found is that people tend to invest in companies that are within 50 or 60 miles of where they live. Not that those companies are any better, but they have more information about those companies. So if you're living in Seattle, there's a higher probability you're going to invest in Boeing, based in Seattle, Microsoft, based there, also Amazon.com, based in that area. So you just want to be cognizant of that, because that can influence our judgment and decision making. Another bias is confirmation bias. So confirmation bias is that we look for information to confirm our very quick judgment. So give you a classic interviewing example. Let's say, for example, you're interviewing for another psychologist or mental health professional. And you ask the first couple of questions, and in your mind, this candidate they're not the one. They've just said some things that make you feel uncomfortable. So then you ask this question. Can you give me another example of when you fail to obey policy? So what you've done is you've fallen victim to confirmation bias. So what happens is you had a prejudgment or an early judgment, and then you selectively filtered out information that would contradict that, and you selectively filtered in information, yep, that would confirm that early judgment. So you want to be very careful about confirmation bias. Take a look at this slide. So the price, the share of Apple prices is dropping. And so what would you do with confirmation bias? So with confirmation bias, if you're upset about this because you're holding Apple, you would not read any bad stories about Apple. You'd only read good stories about Apple. So what's very important is that when we're objective, that we truly are objective, and we look for information that's balanced. So information that supports your point of view, information that's neutral to your point of view, and, most importantly, information that is contradictory to your point of view. That's the way to at least minimize confirmation bias. So now let's look at representative bias. So here's the example. If the market is falling and people might say, hey, this market looks just like it did in 2008, 2009. Or they may say it was just like the dot-com bust. Or they might say it was just like Black Monday in 1987. So here, what we're doing is there's an event that occurs, positive or negative. We're trying to make sense of this event. So then we, in our mind, say this is similar to that. So that's the representative bias. But you also want to keep in mind is if the market is falling now, maybe it's similar to 2008, 2009, maybe it's similar to dot-com, maybe it's similar to Black Monday in 1987, but it's not the same. So you want to make sure that you have a nuanced and an updated strategy to deal with that, whether it's a falling market or a rising market. The next one is called anchoring bias. And let me use the example of you buy a home and then you sell a home. So it's 2005 and you bought that home for $200,000. And you thought, hey, that's a good deal. I'm going to buy that home, 2005, $200,000. 2016, yep, that house is now appreciated $100,000, so it's on the market for $300,000. So that's how much it's increased in value when you did a comp study. So what would be your asking price? Would your asking price be anchored to what you bought it for, $200,000, or would your asking price be anchored to what the value is today, $300,000? Now, for most people, it's going to be anchored to the $300,000. But even if you anchored it to the $200,000 and your asking price was $250,000, did you make a profit? So the question, did you make a profit, depends upon where you anchored it. So if the asking price is $250,000, you made a $50,000 profit if you anchored to $200,000. But if you anchored to $300,000, you got a $50,000 loss. So when homes go up and down and you're making a determination as to whether I buy or whether I sell, then stop and ask yourself is, what am I anchoring to? The high point, the average, or the low point? If you're thinking about selling an investment, what am I anchoring to? The high point, the middle point, or the low point? So you really want to think about what is the anchor and how does that influence my decision to buy something or to sell something? So we just finished off looking at anchoring biases, so now we're going to look at another bias, and that's cognitive bias. But not just cognitive bias, I want to focus on something that's called overconfidence. So let's look at overconfidence as it relates to investing. So here's the question. Who's more overconfident when it comes to investing? So is it men or is it women or neither one? So just think for a moment, and the answer may not be surprising. It's actually men are overconfident when it comes to investing. So what's the so what on that? The so what on that is that they've looked at the investment portfolios of men and the investment portfolios of women. Men tend to trade more. And each time you trade more, so you sell something and you buy something, you sell something and you buy something, there's always a transaction cost to that. The other thing that men tend to do as well is they tend to misread the market because they're overconfident. So as a result, their portfolios in general are not as great. So this may be a recommendation. So if you're involved in a relationship, so maybe you need to leave most of the investment decisions to the woman and not to the man. But you handle that in your own relationship. But this is empirically demonstrated. So that really completes the section as it relates to cognitive biases. And it's important to recognize those for yourselves, yep, as a psychologist and mental health professional, as well as perhaps from your clients or patients if they're bringing up issues related to money. So now we're going to make a shift a little bit and talk not so much about personal financial management, but really your practice. So whether it's an individual practice, whether it's a group practice, or whether you're an employee of a particular organization. But we're still staying on the financial theme. Let's talk a bit about pricing. So some of you will say, hey, Marty, why are we talking about pricing? Because all that's set by CMS, it's set by Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and the payers. Yes, to a degree, but I'm going to stretch you a little bit to think beyond just reimbursement. So first, let's look at a pricing strategy. So you want to be very strategic and purposeful when you set your prices. So let's look at a definition for this. A pricing strategy is a strategic tool that you can use to differentiate your products and services to achieve a competitive advantage. Imagine this. You're a psychologist. There are 10 other psychologists in your community. Of course, you're going to try to differentiate is that maybe you're board certified, you went to a better school, you have a doctorate, you have more credentials. That really isn't what I call an input factor differentiation. Most clients are going to expect that you're highly credentialed and you're highly educated. That's really not going to differentiate you. So then you're going to say, well, maybe I'll try a differentiation strategy based upon quality of services. So you say you provide the highest quality. That's probably not going to differentiate you because most clients expect what? High quality. Who wants a low quality mental health professional? Not too many people. So what does that leave you with? It could be the unique skills and knowledge that you have as it pertains to delivering value for your clients. It's also about your pricing as well. So if your prices are very, very low compared to the market, you're sending a signal. So you're sending a signal is, I'm cheaper, but then people may ask the question is, yeah, maybe you're like a little bit too cheap. What am I really going to get in return? Or if you set them too high, what happens is people may say, am I actually going to get more value out of it? So pricing is about not just the set price that you have, but also what are the payment terms? So do you take cash? Do you take credit cards? Do you take, you know, Apple Pay and Google Pay and Android Pay? Do you take PayPal? So these are all things you want to think about when you're establishing a pricing strategy. So let's do a quick scenario to take a look at this. So a mini case. A therapist is considering opening up a second office in one of the fastest growing suburbs in the city. The suburb is attracting upper middle class families, so important point. Upper middle class families. If you were to advise this therapist on how to set prices, which of the four types of pricing strategies would you recommend for this particular therapist? So would you say, I think you ought to go cost pricing. So what's cost pricing? Cost pricing is you look at all your operational expenses and you basically match that. So hopefully you wouldn't choose cost pricing, because if you choose cost pricing, all you're going to do is break even. Now, breaking even is good, particularly when you're new to your own practice, but you can't have a sustainable practice based upon cost pricing and a break even. So strike cost. Let's look at cost plus. So cost plus is you make sure you cover all your operational expenses. The plus factor is any margin or profit that you may need above and beyond that. That's the plus factor. So this begs the question, is how much plus ought you have? So there you want to look at the other particular providers in your community, and that'll give you a sense of where that plus comes in. So think about cost plus. The next is demand. So let's say, as an example, you are the only psychologist or mental health professional in your area that's treating PTSD for those people that are coming back from the wars. So if that's the case, and a number of people in your community, have served in, the armed forces, if your demand is higher for unique service, you can charge a higher price. And the reason why you can charge a higher price if demand for your services is higher is because there's a shortage. So what this means is that your pricing strategy may actually fluctuate time over time depending upon changes in demand. The next is value. And value is very popular now in healthcare because there's a whole bunch of discussions and presentations about shifting from volume to value. So when you think about value-based pricing, typically that looks at quality, it looks at safety, it looks at satisfaction. But that's typically looking at it from the lens of the payer, so CMS, Blue Cross Blue Shield, but you also want to look at value from the perspective of the user, the patient, or the client. Now I'm going to come back to value because I'm going to introduce you to a tool called the Business Model Canvas that really looks at the value proposition. So let's do a recap on this. So if you were to advise this particular therapist, definitely not cost. Maybe cost plus. If they're providing a unique skill set, demand, and if they can differentiate on value by having a well-defined value proposition, then it would be value. So it's very important for you to think about how are you going to price your services, and it typically needs to go above and beyond just the fee schedule. So now let's look at two markets and staying on the theme as it relates to pricing your services. So you have the reimbursement market and you have the retail market. On the bottom there, it's actually three markets. You have the business or the employer market. So let's first take a look at the reimbursement market. So here you're responding to payers. And actually, when you have contracts with insurance companies, who's the customer? It's not the patient, it's not the client, it's the insurance company. Who's the customer? So here you have a high administrative and compliance burden. Let's say, for example, that in your practice you take 10 different health plans. Unfortunately, those 10 different health plans have 10 different, policies and rules and forms and procedures. So that's a very high administrative burden and a compliance burden. The other thing about this reimbursement market is a lot of your revenue is at risk. And it's at risk because you may charge $200 for a service, but you may not actually get $200 back. So you charge $200, you may only collect $180, and you may spend $10 to collect that. So I'm not saying the reimbursement market is a bad market, but you need to look at what are the pros and the cons of the reimbursement market. So what's the benefit of the reimbursement market? One is they can send you patients or clients through their networks because you may be listed in the directory and you're in the network. So sometimes people will say yes to the reimbursement market because they're getting volume in return and also they're doing the sales and marketing for you. Now let's flip over to the retail market. So the retail market, the health insurance plan is not the customer. Who's the customer? It's the patient and the client because they're paying out of their pocket. They're the customer, which is a little bit different. And you have lower administrative as well as a compliance burden because it's a retail transaction. could be cash, could be credit card, whatever it is, it's a retail transaction. So you don't need to fill out a whole bunch of forms. Now, if you take credit cards, you're going to have to pay a little processing fee, but in no way, shape, or form is it similar to the administrative burden in the reimbursement market. In here, your net revenue is less at risk because, again, you charge $200, and then if they pay in full within 30 days, you get $200. So it's a little bit less at risk. Now, there will be certain patients or clients that may stiff you, so you may have to put them in collections, but that's a reality to it, but your revenue is less at risk. So we've talked about the reimbursement market. We've talked about the retail market. So now, this is an emerging market, and I really want you to think about this as psychologists and mental health professionals. It's the business or the employer market. Now, some of you may be thinking is, hey, but I'm not an industrial organizational psychologist, or I'm not that type of licensed clinical social worker where I really have, you know, provide services to organizations. I don't do seminars. I don't do workshops. You don't have to. You can still provide clinical services, if that's your orientation, within those settings. How so? A lot of businesses now, they're extremely upset about the high price increases that they're paying for insurance for their employees. So what they're beginning to do is looking at direct contracting. So how would direct contracting work? You would have a large corporation or a large purchasing group, and what this corporation would do or purchasing group is they would directly contract with a practice, a mental health practice. And then when they do this direct contracting, then they will give you a certain fee, yep, to care for X number of patients or clients in exchange for that fee. And they may use this term called per member per month, which is similar to an HMO term, or they may use the term per capita. So let's say this organization has 1,000 employees. So they'll say to you, if you're the provider, we'll give you $25 per month per employee if you provide clinical services to this employee population. So where the risk comes in is you're going to get a fixed amount of money, so you really have to make sure that you manage utilization because there could be overutilization. And on their side, they're concerned about underutilization. So with any type of model, there are risks, and there's an upside and there's a downside, and you have to be selective about that upside and downside. Now, I recognize that some of you are very involved in employee assistance programs, or EAPs, beginning to get involved in worksite wellness programs and health promotion programs. So those are examples of that business employer market. And what I would suggest is this, is maybe you don't make a forced choice that either I do reimbursement, or I do retail, or I do business or employer. Maybe what you may want to do is choose 3 out of 3 or 2 out of 3. So myself, as an example, I used to play in the reimbursement market, no longer play in that market because it was too frustrating for me, and that was my choice. So now play in the retail market as well as in the business and employer market. So that may not be right for you, but I was very, very intentional about making that shift. So I think it's important that you sit back and reflect upon what type of business do you want to have with regard to your practice and be intentional about the market, and that will help you with your pricing strategies. So now let's shift to looking at the value proposition. I introduced that a couple of minutes ago. So when you think about, remember, pricing, you can price one of the ways is by focusing on value, but what is a value proposition? So a value proposition is, it's the perceived value, keyword here is perceived, not actual, the perceived value that your customer has with regard to your services. And what they're looking at is how much does it cost in contrast to what do I get from that. So that's why I wanted to introduce the topic about different marketplaces, because you may have the health plan as a customer, you may have the patient or client as a customer, and or you may have the business or employer as a customer. And the perceived value is going to be different depending upon who that customer is. So this is a map, and it's a map of the customer value proposition. So if you take a look at this map, you have the customer segment, and then you have the value proposition. What most practices tend to do is they begin with their own value proposition first, and then they think about the customer. Wrong order. You want to think about the customer first, identify their pains and gains, and I'll talk about that. Identify the job that they want done, so you're really doing a diagnostic, if you will, an assessment. What is it the customer wants or needs or has to have done? Then based upon that, you look at, well, where can I come in and provide some value? And then you develop your value proposition. So imagine this, and I use this as an example. You are a trauma psychologist or therapist. So you specialize in working with adults and children that maybe they've been victims of physical trauma, emotional trauma, sexual trauma, just a whole slew of different traumas. So the customer segment is going to be somewhat narrow in this case. So you're going to say, I'm only looking at those individuals that perhaps have been diagnosed or present with things related to trauma. So then we got to go a little bit deeper because that's just a diagnostic label. And let's go a little bit deeper on that. So when you think about these clients or patients, what are some common pains and or gains that they have? So the pains may be symptom. The gains might be, I want to have a relief of suffering. I don't want to have nightmares. I don't want to restrict my life activities. So you have to look at what are the pains and what are the gains. Because for most of us, when we're involved in a transaction, then we spend money, we spend time, we spend energy to get something, the gain. Or we spend time, money, and energy to feel better or to feel in less distress to remove the pain. So it's both the pain and the gain. Then you want to ask the next question. So we're still saying on the customer segment side of the map. What are the jobs to be done? So maybe people want to improve their functional status. Maybe people want to feel better emotionally. Maybe people want to go through life without experiencing a number of physiological symptoms. Those are jobs to be done. And think about it. People will contract with you in order to get a job done. Now, in the work that we do as psychologists and mental health professionals, that work to be done is often at the level of emotions, at the level of relationships, and improved functioning. But it's still, I want to get something done. It's a little bit more goal-focused. Now, once you've gotten information about the pains and the gains, as well as you have information about the jobs to be done, now you're educated and informed about, in this case, those patients or clients that are suffering from trauma. So you take that information that you learned on the customer side, and then you begin to craft your value proposition. So what are the products and services that you can provide to get the jobs done, help them with their gains and with their pains? That's how you really develop a good value proposition, and you want to put this value proposition in writing as well, because it's going to become the essence of your positioning statement. So what's your positioning statement? How do you stand out in a market? Some markets are very crowded. There's an oversupply of psychologists and mental health professionals, and some there's an undersupply. But how are you going to position yourself? So that's the map. And if you take a look in the middle there, you see the word fit. So you want to make sure that the services and goods you're providing fit with the pains, the gains, and the jobs to be done of the customer segment. So we just reviewed the value proposition map. Now let's look at the value proposition tool. It's a nice summary for yourselves. So we're always going to begin with the customer segment because that's where you begin. So you look at the gains as well as the pains and the jobs to be done by the customer. And if you'll remember is that you are discovering that through questions and other sources of information to find out what that is in a very non-judgmental fashion. Then what you do is once you've discovered that, then you look at how am I actually going to create a package of goods and services and products. So you're going to look at gain creators. And you're also going to look at pain relievers. And then those things are going to be embedded within the design of your products and services. So that's the value proposition tool. So this is an exercise that I would encourage you to do, and you may want to do it now. So, you know, just imagine, just stop the tape and then do the exercise. So this is knowing my customers. So I've provided two segments for you. So you have customer number one and customer number two. So let's say, for example, we're staying on the same example for the trauma services. So it may be a pediatric trauma patient. What are their pains and what are their gains? The other one could be an adult trauma patient. What are their pains and what are their gains? If you note, there's a subtle distinction here because I looked at demography on top of the underlying psychological issue. I said pediatric, their pains and gains are going to be different than the adult. Their pains and gains are going to be different. And if you're specializing in pediatric practice or with children, you actually are going to have two customers. You're going to have the child, him or herself, as well as their parent, grandparent, or guardian. So it's very important to keep that in mind. And what you do is you just identify what these are, but you're not judging them. So, and don't go to the literature only. Because what we tend to do as educated mental health practitioners is we go to the literature only. The literature is a presentation of evidence-based scientific management. That's important. But the literature is not giving any information about customers. So go to the literature, but please also go to customers as well if you really want to have a customer-focused practice. So we're continuing on the theme for the value proposition. So I talked about positioning. So positioning is based upon your unique value proposition. How do you carve out a unique space in the market such that your practice can be more successful depending upon how you define success? So you can probably say this by now. You're going to look at the gains and the pains of your customer segments. You're also going to look at demographics. So are they pediatric? Are they adolescent? Are they adult? Are they midlife? Are they, you know, elderly, the old, whatever it may happen to be? You could cut it by gender. You can cut it by race or ethnicity. You can cut it by income groups. And you're going to look at psychographics. So are they digital natives? Yep, or maybe they're paper-based. Are they time-starved? So you can cut it by different psychographics and diagnostics, which we talked about trauma, and coverage. So do they have a health plan? Do they have a health savings account? Or are they on the retail market? So when you're thinking about your customers, you really try to want to take a holistic view because that's going to inform you about the design of therapeutic or diagnostic products and services that are tailored and will match that particular customer segment. So let's take a look at this as another assignment for you. And so don't be intimidated by all the blank spaces there. So let's look at customer segments. So at the top there, you see patient and or family. So again, let's use the example of the trauma psychologist or the trauma mental health professional. So what's the job to be done? What's the pain they want avoided? What's the gain they want delivered? And likewise, you would go all the way down the list. So let's stop there and take a look at employer. So imagine this. You are an employer, and you're the vice president of benefits, or you're the vice president of human resources, and your workforce is 500 employees. It's probably a high probability, maybe 5-10% of your working population has some symptoms related to trauma. So what's the organizational impact on that? The organizational impact is they might be suffering from absenteeism. They might be suffering from presenteeism. They may have higher utilization of healthcare services. Their performance may not be as great. So even as an employer, there are certain pains and gains. So it's important that you look at all those customer segments, and then you make a decision. Yep, which segments am I going to go after? So for a lot of psychologists and mental health professionals, we tend to only go after the individual client, or we tend to go only after the family, and that's appropriate. But as you can see in this particular example for this assignment, you can go broader if you wish. So now I'm going to present a tool for you called the Business Model Canvas. So some of you may be familiar with this tool. Now, some of you I know, as soon as you see the word business, it's like, I don't want to talk about that. But when running a practice, you actually are running a business. I would argue that. So this tool was really designed as a tool that you would use before you develop a business plan. It was also designed as a tool to get you to create a picture, a visualization of actually your business or your practice. So let's take a look at it. So I want you to begin with the customer side. So very similar to what we just reviewed about articulating your value proposition, you're going to look at your customer segments. So we went over that. Remember, we talked about demographics and psychographics. Then you're going to look at your customer relationships. So really, what's unique in the way that you relate to your customers? Do you really focus on integrity? Do you focus on having quick service, reliable service? Do you focus on going above and beyond? So what are those things that are unique in the way you relate to your customers? Then you look at your channels. So your channels are your distribution. So for most mental health professionals and psychologists, it's still live face-to-face. But with the emergence of mobile health and telehealth, not only is it becoming live face-to-face, but it's also becoming live, yep, but not necessarily face-to-face. It would be face-to-face through a camera. Increasingly, some are also using internet as well. So it's not face-to-face, but it's instant messaging. So the channels are definitely increasing and changing as it relates to the provision of mental health and psychological services. And that will continue. So by looking at those customer segments, then that moves you into your value proposition. And we reviewed that, and that's where you would insert your value proposition statement. So now you have to look at is how do things run in your business or practice. So the first thing are key activities. So you register patients, you see patients, you bill for patients, you may have staff meetings. So those are all the key activities that have to be done. Your operations, if you will. Then you look at key resources. So an office, equipment, supplies, staff. So those are the key resources that you have. And then you have to look at key partners, referral relationships, maybe testing companies that supply you with certain things, maybe your webmaster. So those are all your key partners. Then at the very bottom there, you look at the financial pieces of it. So what's your cost structure? So that's why we spent the first part of this presentation talking about the balance statement, the income statement, profit or loss, as well as the cash flow statement, because you're going to bring that understanding to your cost structure. And what are your revenue opportunities? Because those revenue opportunities go back to our discussion about pricing. Remember, I said that there was a retail market, there's a reimbursement market, and there's a growing business employer market. So what are all the different ways that you can bring in revenue? In general, you want to diversify your revenue stream. So if you're 100% reimbursed and you only have one or two health plans and they snatch your contract, you're in trouble because you're not going to be able to shift very quickly. But if you have 10 or more plans, you can shift if one of them snatches the contract or significantly changes the terms of the contract. So remind yourself to think about how can I diversify my revenue stream. And if you'll remember, I play in the employer market. I also play increasingly in the retail market. And I'm now expanding to different channels by looking at digital channels as well. And I've done that by design because I want to make sure that I'm going through different channels. So I'm diversifying my channels. What I'm also doing is diversifying my revenue stream. And what does that do? That lowers my risk. And if it lowers my risk, I can sleep a little bit better at night. So it's kind of a win-win from a number of different perspectives. If you Google Business Model Canvas, you'll find quite a bit of information on it. And you can also download things from Word docs, or you can download Excel spreadsheets as templates, and you can fill it in. And there are a number of perhaps videos on YouTube that you can watch that further explain the Business Model Canvas. If you're a solo practitioner, you may want to do this and then get feedback from your key partners so they can give you their suggestions about it. If you're the director or manager of a group practice, this may be something that you want to do at a retreat or at a staff meeting and get everybody involved in the practice to actually fill it out. And then you can blow it up to be wall size, if you will. And if you blow it up to be wall size, it's something that can be kind of the guiding light, if you will, of your practice. So now we're going to shift. So we talked about pricing. We talked about the business model canvas. So we're going to take a little bit at a skill that's very important is negotiations. And why is negotiations important? When you're dealing in the reimbursement market primarily, as well as the business or employment market, you have to be able to negotiate. So what negotiation is, it's a set of tools. So decision-making tools, problem-solving tools, communication tools to get the best for you. Now what that means is you can get the best for you without harming or hurting somebody else. So it's important to keep that in mind. So you can have some degree of compassion. But fundamentally, what you actually negotiate in your business is with regard to mental health and psychology or a host of contracts, employment contracts. It could be cleaning contracts. It could be insurance contracts, a whole host of contracts. So what's a contract? It's a document that describes the relationship between two parties, such as a health plan or a provider. And this is defined by an agreement that spells out rights and responsibilities of each party. And most contracts are enforceable by state laws, and in some cases, maybe by federal laws. So when you're engaged in contracting, you do have to attend not only legal issues, but ethical issues and business issues. So be aware of contracts that are difficult to negotiate. I was recently working with a health system, and I have a mobile app that was developed, and I sent the mobile app to them. We were getting ready to go through the contracting phase to do a pilot for this mobile app. They sent me back, it must have been a 60-page contract. That contract was written by probably a whole team of attorneys. So that was just too difficult for me to negotiate with, let alone understand it. So I retained outside counsel and attorney. They reviewed it. I made sure they didn't spend too much time on it because that bill would keep ticking up. They reviewed it and talked about all the complexities and the intricacies of this contract. So I made a decision, yep, not to move forward in terms of them looking at that mobile app to do a pilot study with that health system because that would have been just too difficult to negotiate. The other is too difficult to administer. Same lessons applies with that particular contract. If I had actually signed the contract and moved forward, how was I going to administer that? Because it would require so much documentation on a quarterly basis, my administrative burden would be too high. And the final part is difficulty to enforce. There were so many nuances and provisions in that contract that it made me, quite frankly, a little bit scared and upset about if I don't do something or I do something at a certain date, what's the bad thing that's going to happen? And are they going to come after me? So it wasn't worth the grief. So in general, I love contracts that are easy to understand by a layperson or a non-attorney, and also that are easy to administer and easy to enforce, even before I get to the negotiation phase. So let's do this as a self-assessment. So do you possess some of these negotiation skills? So one is enthusiasm. So it's enthusiasm about wanting to do business with the other party. It's enthusiasm is that you have something truly of value that can benefit the other party. And then when you're enthusiastic, you have to display confidence, but you have to do it in a way that fits with your own style. Recognition. So maybe kind of flattering, if you will, to some degree, and recognizing why you want to do business with this other party, what value they provide. Because most people and organizations like to know that they're special in some respect. And integrity. So you may want to be a tough bargainer, but you want to be ethical, you want to tell the truth, and you do not want to intentionally do any harm, and you want to be perceived as trustworthy. The other skills that you have to have when you're negotiating are social skills. So it all depends upon the region of the country and who you're negotiating with. Typically, there's some pleasantries and some civility that you'll do, and then you do the negotiation. Then you want to close in a very agreeable fashion as well, and always show interest in others. And you want to exhibit teamwork. What I try to do when I sit across the table before I negotiate is really look at that other party, not as an adversary, not as an opposing party, but as a member of my team, that both of us have initially thought that there's some value in us coming together, and now what we have to work out are the particular nuances and differences, so that way both of us get value coming out of this deal. And teamwork implies some degree of self-control, because there may be occasions somebody will say something or do something that you may experience as a slight. So what's your natural tendency? Do you get a little bit despondent? Do you get a little bit sarcastic? And I'm guilty of being sarcastic at times when I get irritated. Or do you get a little bit angry and you kind of want to like hit them? So you have to have some degree of self-control. And you want to be creative, because a lot of contracts are written by attorneys, but you can go above and beyond that as long as you don't break the law. So I would strongly encourage you to be creative when you're negotiating. And you're always looking for a way to reach a yes. So those are some skills that are extremely important when you are negotiating for a whole variety of contracts. So now let's look at a technique and a particular methodology called the bargaining zone. So I'm going to use an example of buying a car. So if you look there, you're in green and the car dealer is in red. So your asking price for the car there is $25,000. So you want to go in, you want to buy the car for $25,000. Then if you look at the price that the dealer has, the dealer there is at $28,000. So there's a difference. Now for the dealer, they have something that's called an RP. The RP is a resistance point. So their resistance point is at $30,000. You likewise have a resistance point. Your resistance point is at 32. So if you think about this, is there's a bargaining zone there in the middle, because there's a point that you're not going to pay any more, and there's a point for the dealer, they're not going to go below a certain amount. So you have to be able to try to identify what that sweet spot is. But in a lot of cases, what happens when you're negotiating is you're not going to reveal your resistance point, nor will the other side reveal their resistance point. So you have this going back, testing it. And when I'm negotiating with someone about a price, say, for example, someone say, Marty, I want you to come in and do a seminar or workshop. So I'll throw out a price. If they don't clear their throat, if they don't give me a funny look, if there's no odd facial expression, or if they don't say it's too much, then I know I didn't hit their resistance point. I came in too low. So you really want to make sure when you throw out that price that you make it slightly negative reaction. That's a good thing. Not that they have a negative reaction, but what it tells you is, ah, I hit their resistance point. Because when you know you hit the resistance point, it tells you I got to come down a little bit. So if you find that you are bidding out services and people are not responding kind of in a little bit of an upset way, you're asking for way too little. You need to ask for a little more. The other thing that happens when I'm negotiating certain contracts as well is someone may say, hey, that price is too high. So then what I'll come back and say is, I can appreciate that and I can understand that. Would you like for me to refer you to somebody that's a bit cheaper? A bit cheaper. Most people are not going to say, yeah, give me the referral to the cheaper people. So then they stop and they say, well, no, I don't want somebody that's cheaper. If I want somebody to provide value, but they cost less. Then I'll say it usually one more time. Well, sure, I can definitely refer you to these three people and they're a whole lot cheaper. I don't keep saying that, but I say it another time. And in some cases, what happens is their resistance price now goes up. So they're okay with a higher amount. So you have to make a decision about whether you would do that particular technique or not. So when you're negotiating, you have to have some degree of flexibility and you have to have some degree of creativity. and you don't want to throw all your cards out there in advance, and you want to try to find out what their hidden cards are. So some may be saying, is this sounds kind of gamey, and it is kind of gamey, and it's not for everybody. So if you're the owner of a practice or you're kind of the managing director of a practice, maybe you're not the one to do the negotiating. Maybe there's somebody else that likes it better and is more effective. So those are discussions that you have to have within your own organization. So another key point when you look at negotiation is you got to know when you walk away from the deal. So there's something that's called a BATNA. So does anybody know what a BATNA is? So a BATNA is the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. The best alternative to a negotiated agreement. So let's say you're contracting, say you want to get into telehealth. So you're contracting with two companies that provide telehealth equipment. And then one of them, the price is too high. So since you've actually explored two companies, you may have a BATNA. Because if company A is too high, your best alternative to a negotiated agreement is to go with company B. So another way of looking at a BATNA is your backup plan or your contingency plan. But if you're only negotiating with one, and they get a sense you're only negotiating with one, you have no BATNA. And if you have no BATNA, you're caged in a bit. So it's always wise to have a BATNA. Don't reveal it initially, but if you have to retreat, then you can retreat. And then sometimes what you'll find is if you say, well, I'd love to do business with you, but your price point's just too high, so I did explore other options, and let me tell you about those other options. So in some cases, now the negotiation has opened up again. So what's your BATNA backup plan or contingency plan? And don't think by having a BATNA that you're pessimistic or that you're negative. You're not. It just enables you to free you up, to explore other options in case you have to. Because typically the other side, they also have a BATNA. So in the example I gave you, you're looking for telehealth equipment. You're not the only customer out there. So if you say no, they're going to move on because they got a customer list. So let's kind of recap where we've been, and now we're going to focus on getting your financial house in order. So we really began with looking at personal financial management. Then we transition to really looking at your practice as a business, your pricing strategy, the business model, and some tips and techniques about how you negotiate, primarily contracts. So now we're going to kind of finish it off looking at your financial house, and we'll use that as a metaphor. So this is a classic, if you will, representation of the financial house. It's actually a pyramid, but you can extend the metaphor. So you really want to use this almost as a checklist or as a guiding framework for yourself. So I'm going to work through this pyramid from the bottom to the top. So on the bottom there is protection. You want to make sure that even before you do any saving and investing, you're protected. Do you have disability insurance? Do you have life insurance? Do you have malpractice insurance? Do you have health insurance? So do you have insurance to protect you? So to protect you from what? Possible hazards that may arise in your practice, hence malpractice. Possible hazards that may arise, you slip and fall, and you can no longer practice, so do you have disability? So it's extremely important that you have that protection first. And what are you protecting? You're protecting current income, you're also protecting future income, and you're protecting the assets that you've worked so hard to build over time. So that protection is critical. So once you have that protection in place, then you move up to regular savings. So remember we talked about you want to pay yourself first. For that regular savings, you may first save to your emergency fund because there are expenses that come up. Your refrigerator's working fine, then all of a sudden you wake up tomorrow morning, boom, it's on the fritz. So now you've got maybe $1,100, $1,500 expense on that. 2 weeks after that, car's going fine. You hear this rattle, rattle, rattle. You send it into the shop, and they say, we can remove the rattle for $800. So if you don't have an emergency fund, where's that going to come from? And then once you have a good emergency fund, then you also want to have retirement and then savings. And then maybe there's going to be a big blowout vacation in the summer. So are you saving for that? Maybe there's an upcoming wedding. Are you saving for that? Then you move up to growth and diversification. So growth is your money growing. So how does money grow? Money grows through interest. Yep. Money grows through appreciation. So you may have stocks, you may have bonds, you may have mutual funds, you may have ETFs. So you really want to make sure that your money works for you. And then you go up to the next level. The next level is really optional. This next level is called speculation. And this can be dangerous, so I'm not suggesting it, but some people do engage in speculation. So you may do day trading. You may play in the commodities. You may buy oil grants and leases. So be very careful when you begin to get in that particular sector, because it can be extremely risky. So you can lose your shirt and a couple of shirts, but on the flip side, you can get a lot of gain. So you want to be extremely careful about that. And you definitely want to make sure that if you move into speculation, that you're not using any assets that you will need for the remainder of your life. So I'm not recommending that, but I want to present this as part of the financial pyramid. And then you finally go up, and then you have wealth. So people often say, what's the difference between wealth and income? So income is what comes in your paycheck, or what comes in the mail, if you will, from the work that you do. Whereas wealth is the accumulation of assets over time. So it may be assets that you worked for, or you may be fortunate enough to maybe you inherited some assets. So in general, when you look at wealth, let's say, for example, you have $1 million set aside as an investable asset. So if you have $1 million set aside as an investable asset, and if you were to take 4% out of it a year, yep, that would be $40,000 a year that's coming from that $1 million. That's wealth. But over time, what's going to happen is that $1 million is going to shrink if you keep taking $40,000 out of it every single year. Unless that $1 million that you have set up in an account, it's generating 6% interest a year. So if it's generating 60% interest a year, it's going to grow by $60,000. You're taking out 40, so it's actually growing by $20,000. So ideally, what you want to try to be able to do, and it's not possible for everybody, is to really try to get some wealth. Because when you have wealth, what wealth is doing, it's your money working for you and your money making money. And maybe the amount's not $1 million, maybe it's $300,000 or $200,000. And you want to demystify what it means to be wealthy. So it's not necessarily people that have 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 million dollars, it's a relative term. And if you'll also remember as well is that money, by and large, doesn't buy what? Happiness. So that's the financial pyramid, and I would critically review that and say, where am I? Or if you're involved in a relationship, where are we? And I would also share that with maybe clients that may be struggling financially. Share it with loved ones as well. Now let me share with you this study that was done. And it's fascinating. So what they did is they looked at people's financial habits before the financial crisis, 2008-2009, and after the financial crisis, 2008-2009. And if you will note, you can see changes in terms of the post-crisis response. So I only listed those things that are statistically significant. So what I would encourage you to do is actually respond to those items that are listed under quiz questions. And do you engage in some of these behaviors? Because remember, the financial pyramid is conceptual, but it's what you decide to do on a daily basis. It's what you do on a daily basis that builds that financial discipline so you can move from protection to regular savings to growth and diversification, and ultimately maybe to wealth. So it's very important to remember that you can control your financial decisions and your behavior in most respects. So let's review kind of where we began and to see whether we actually accomplished our objectives. First one, If you'll remember, we talked about the three questions and the four jobs of money. So do you remember, not necessarily all the three questions or the four jobs. So money has a purpose, and that was reflected in those four jobs of money. If you'll also remember, we talked about the three B's of money. So it was biology, it was behavior, and it was beliefs. And I also threw in cognition there as well, but it messes up with three B's. Then we looked at the differences between interior and exterior finance. And we basically came away with the conclusion is that you can't solve interior problems through money alone. Money helps to a certain point, but not through money alone. Then we looked at those four types of money beliefs, like money avoidance, money worshipers, and I asked you to kind of categorize where you were. And it might be an appropriate tool for your clients and patients as well. Recognizing, too, that those money beliefs are modifiable, and you want to make sure if you're a parent or aunt or uncle or grandparent, how are you shaping and influencing the money beliefs of those that are important to you and special to you? Then we looked at pricing. We looked at different pricing models. How do you price your services? And I really want you to focus on value, because what's happening in the formal healthcare delivery system is we're shifting from volume to value. But we also talked about demand. Then we spent quite a bit of time looking at your value proposition. And the key point here is customer first, then you design your products and services to meet the gains and the pains and to do the jobs that the customer wants done, recognizing that they're different customers. And then we just recently finished up on the negotiation piece, primarily looking at contracts. And do you have certain skills that are associated with negotiating success? And just finished off on the financial house. And I want to end by looking at how do you leverage your talent as a psychologist and mental health professional such that you can provide the highest quality care for your clients and patients, as well as address issues that are important for you. Because I'm convinced if you're less distressed, if you're less worried about money in your financial house, you're more present and you're more available to truly serve your clients and your patients and being more engaged with those that you love. So I'd like to thank you so much, and I do hope that you found this to be meaningful and that there are one or two things that you might do differently or may have inspired you to think about as you continue to serve others in your practice. We've gotten a number of questions that I'd like to respond to, so I'm first going to tell you what the question is and then give you my response. The first one is this, is should we bring up issues related to money with our patients and clients? And you're going to hate the answer, but the answer is it depends. So I don't think you should force that topic on your patients or clients, but let's imagine this. You have one of your patients or clients, and they report, that they're feeling a little bit upset or distressed about the fact that they're going to have to delay their retirement by 3 to 4 years. So that's something that you don't want to ignore. At a minimum, you want to find out a little bit more about that. And what they might disclose is they went to their accountant or they went to their financial planner and they gave them some retirement projections, and they found is they do have to work 5 more years such that they can build up their retirement nest egg to retire. So I think explore it a little bit, and that may be enough. But if they continue to talk about it, and maybe in some way it's related to depression or anxiety or maybe strained relationships or any signs and symptoms related to kind of mental illness, then you probably need to dig a little bit deeper. Rather than taking the stance, if the patient or client says anything about money, anything about work, that's not my terrain, I'm not addressing that. Because what I have found over the years is that many patients and clients, when they go to their estate attorneys, when they go to financial planners, where they go to accountants, is they bring up issues that really are within the terrain of mental health professionals. And often what happens is the accountants, the financial planners, the attorneys, they get a little bit freaked out because they don't address it. And then these same people then go to their mental health professionals and psychologists, and they try to bring it up, and they basically get the messages, not here. So where do these folks go? Because remember, we looked at that American Psychological Association survey. Money and finances come up as the top stressors. And it has for a number of years. So I think you at least need to acknowledge it first. Then you make decisions about what you do after that. So that's kind of the first question. So let's go to the second question. How should I handle it if my patients or clients owe me money? So that can be a tough situation to be in. So they're not paying their bills. So in part, it depends upon how you're structured. So if you're a solo practitioner, there's nobody to delegate that to. So you're going to have to address it in a certain way. So how might you address it? I think you need to make sure first you have some clear policies. So the policy might be is before you render services, that if there's a copay, they've paid their copay, and then you can have a discussion about their balances. But in the absence of a clear policy, you're going to have to do it on a case-by-case basis. So first and foremost, yep, you are ethically and legally obligated to provide services, but then you want to bring it up to the client or the patient is, you know, I was reviewing my accounts over the past month, and I've noticed you've fallen behind a bit. Let's talk a little bit about that, and maybe we can do something with the payment plan or find a way for, you know, the monies to come in. Because if you don't bring it up, then you're kind of reinforcing it. There's a famous saying that people say, what you permit, you promote. So you don't necessarily want to promote that. Nor should you get, you know, like completely upset and then say, I'm no longer seeing you, because that could put you at risk for things related to patient abandonment. Now, if you're within an organization and you have somebody that you can delegate that task to, so maybe it's someone in the billing office, maybe it's the receptionist, so then they can address that from a policy and a procedure point of view. But I do think it's critically important that you address that issue. Is it going to be comfortable? Absolutely not. You're going to be a little bit uncomfortable. They're going to be a little bit uncomfortable you bringing it up. But I think it's something you want to bring up, because what you don't want to do is practice with a sense of regret. So then when you see that patient or client, you're thinking, okay, we're going to do what we're going to do, but you owe me some money. So you don't want to do that, because that will interfere with empathy, compassion, and really connecting with that patient or client. So that's a tricky one, but it's an important one. Let's look at a third question. So here someone said they're curious. So you talked about the business model canvas. Is a practice a business? So I think that's a great question. I struggled with that for a number of years. I really struggled with that. So my answer to it is yes. But let's look at this a little bit from an ideological perspective. I do not believe, yep, that businesses by nature are evil. Nor do I believe that business women or men are evil by nature. Businesses are entities that exist within state laws where there's a provision of services or the making of goods in exchange for finances. So if you think about psychological practices or mental health practices, in some states you have actually a professional corporation. So the designation is a PC. So instead of a limited liability company or an S corp or a C corp, there's a PC. And in some states there's a new entity that's emerging, which is called a BC. And a BC is a benefit corporation. The benefit corporation really embraces the whole notion of you can make money while doing good work. So kind of a socially responsible business, if you will. So don't get caught up in the language. So if you want to refer to your practice as a practice, do so. So maybe change the language of the business model canvas to the practice model canvas. But you're still going to have customers. You still have to provide value. Your revenue is still going to have to be higher than your costs. There's still key activities that have to be done. You have to have certain resources, and you're going to have key partners. So don't get caught up on the ideological aspects or the nomenclature, if you will. So my short answer is this. Yes, your practice is a business, but it exists to do good work for clients and patients. Let's look at another question. So can you tell me more about the channels in the business model canvas? So if you remember, when we looked at the business model canvas, in the middle we had the value proposition. And then we had customer segments. Then on the top there we had customer relationships. And right below it we had customer segments. Customer channels. And those customer channels right below it are Do you provide face-to-face services? Do you provide telehealth services? Do you provide maybe therapeutic games and services? Do you provide workshops and seminars? Do you write books? Do you do some blogging? So all of those are the different ways that you can reach your patients, clients, and customers. That's why they call it a channel, from the term a distribution channel. And I would recommend that you probably diversify your distribution channels. And with the mobile revolution or the digital revolution, I think it's extremely important, if you're going to be practicing for 10 or more years, that you really look at is, do you have a digital or a mobile way to reach your customers and patients? Now, maybe that's not traditional, and it isn't, but it's extremely important, because a lot of millennials and others is, that's the channel of choice. So if that's the channel of choice, they may not use other channels and they prefer that channel. So let's look at another question. And this is really kind of a summary question, is what are three takeaways from this particular presentation? And that's a tough one, but I'm going to try to address the three takeaways. So when I really think about it is, the first takeaway is, recognize that money is important. Recognize that money is important to you. It's important to your loved ones. It's important to your patients and your clients. And money actually has jobs that need to be done. Exchange of value. So money is important and it's functional. The second takeaway is this. Build your competence as it relates to financial management in your personal life and in your professional life. And don't say to yourself, as I was never that good in math, because when we looked at the balance statement, the income statement, and the cash flow statement, it's simple arithmetic, division, maybe multiplication, that's it. There's no calculus, there's no algebra, there's no high-level math. And it's important that you are financially competent as a business professional working in the mental health and the psychological space, as well as personally as well. The third takeaway is, treat your practice as a business. But why treat it as a business? Because you want to make sure that your business or your practice is sustainable. Because as long as your practice survives and thrives from a financial point of view, guess what? Your doors are open, and your doors are open to serve others. But if your practice is not financially viable, your door shut down. And when your door shut down, where do patients go? They may go elsewhere, but they're not coming to you. So when you think about sustainability, it has a business impact, it has an access impact, and it can also have a therapeutic impact as well. So those are the three major takeaways.